The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
There's such a deep level of satisfaction getting to work with professionals, but it speaks to who we are as a group, who we are as a team. Professionalism demands our very best. And that's what we want to do. We want to offer our very best to a client base, work our tails off, and put a product or a number of products out there that serve their needs, that answer their questions, that answer that question, quid diende, what is next?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, we have two special guests in the studio today, Dave. But before we go to them, I think we should probably point out this is the first weekly commentary since the European Central Bank went to negative nominal rates. They're literally telling people that they're negative. And this is the first commentary that we've ever had where Trump has tweeted that he wants negative rates as well.
Yeah, I mean, talk about competitive devaluation, talk about trade wars. What do we want? We want to compete on the downside with rates. We want to compete on the downside with, I mean, if you adopt a policy like that, as Carmen Reinhart said a few weeks ago, you're adopting a policy that is intentionally picking the pockets of savers. It's a remarkable period of time. But as you and I have talked about it, you've pointed out, I totally agree, that it suggests a period of desperation.
You know, Dave, I've flown airplanes and I've also turned autopilot on and gotten up and done other things. And you can sometimes fool yourself when you're on autopilot that everything's under control. I was thinking as I was listening to you all talking, before we started doing the recording, if you look at the world and we have, what, $13, $14, $15 trillion worth of negative rates, and now the central bank's going negative, is it more than that?
17 and climbing.
17. Okay. So we can't even keep up with this. Now, that would be a signal to me. If I was flying a plane called the economy, I would say, well, that sounds like there's something terribly, terribly wrong. So I was thinking about it. Who do you want in the cockpit? Because we've had passive investing all these years. Passive investing basically says you do just fine if you just put it in the funds. They'll always go up. It's like typical Wall Street. Just leave it in and you'll do fine over this next 10, 20, 50 year period of time. But the plane is crashing. Okay. We may not know it because of negative rates. Now we're saying, all right, we need an expert in the cockpit. Who do you want in the cockpit? And I was thinking, Doug, Lila, Dave, these are people I think you want in the cockpit when things really do need a pilot again.
Well, the processes that we go through on a weekly basis, this is a part of why this team, I think, is a highly functional team and a highly professional team. You know, in the case of Doug and Lila, they've had a decade to work together. And the reason we're sitting down to talk with them today is because this last week we were gathered to talk to clients. And our annual wealth management conference in Durango, Colorado was happening. We had folks travel from all over the country. So we'll be able to share with you some of the highlights of things in that program in Durango and give you a flavor for the kinds of thinking and the kinds of issues that we're talking about on a routine basis.
Well, and just to build a picture of who is in the studio right now. Okay, well, I'm going to start with you. But, you know, 2 weeks ago, there was a program that we aired with you and your dad talking when you were in Europe. Most of our listeners know who you are, but you come from a family that has a 40, almost 48-year-old company that's been in the hard assets, especially gold and silver, for years. But you've, the last 10 years, you've also moved into money management. Now, when you manage money, you have to have two things definitely going on. You have to be able to look at the macro. This is Doug Nolan's specialty, probably one of the best in the world. And you have to have the micro, somebody who can take the time to look at the details of every company. That's Lila Murphy. And so as you're listening to this commentary, listener, picture those elements as they speak.
Every year since 2008, we've had a client conference meeting here in Durango, Colorado for our wealth management clients. And this last week, we were able to gather with folks from all over the country here in Durango. So for the portfolio managers and analysts who make McIlvaney Wealth Management what it is, I just wanted to be able to unpack a little bit of that for our listening audience, because I think it's a very solid opportunity to have your mind on things. So let me tell you what we typically do. On a Monday and on a Wednesday, we're doing our portfolio manager meetings. And on those meetings, we have Doug Noland, we have Lila Murphy, we have Robert Draper, we have myself. And so the four of us are on and discussing what's happening in the markets. And I thought today we might look at one of those kind of portfolio manager meetings, the kinds of things that we talk about and what's top of mind. Doug, you're always covering the macro for us. And so I think we should, before too much time passes, reflect on last week, reflect on the central bank there in Europe and some of the decisions they made. I'm sure you've got some opinions. Give us a little bit of the macro perspective, things that have changed, things that remain the same. Work us through some of the statistics that you think are important for us to bear in mind, and give us a flavor, perhaps, for how we spend our Mondays and Wednesdays as a team.
Sure, David. Let's start by going back to December and January. The markets were unstable. We saw indications of de-risking, deleveraging. Very quickly, markets turned illiquid, I think back to January 3rd, and a lot of my indicators were showing acute stress starting to unfold in the markets. Not a big surprise the next day, unscheduled, Chairman Powell comes out and does the Fed U-turn to dovishness. That was followed by central banks globally, and we saw last week the ECB restarted QE. Which is rather amazing if you think about it. They expanded their balance sheet by $2.6 trillion. They finally ended that program, and not that many months later, they restarted. And they restarted, you know, sure, there's some weakness in Germany, but the Eurozone economy continues to expand. Equity prices have posted huge gains. We've seen, you know, very loose financial conditions throughout European credit system, the bond markets there. But they restarted QE. We've seen this year also the Chinese have hit the accelerator yet again. Credit growth in China is running approximately 20-25% above comparable 2018 levels. The Fed will see another rate reduction this week, so they're stimulating. And what's dramatic to me, David, is that we're seeing extreme monetary stimulus with equity prices at all-time highs. The economy's plugging along. These are the type of measures you would expect in a crisis environment. Now they're using these measures to keep the market strong. So I find it all rather troubling. Under the surface of the markets, we're seeing a lot of instability, the so-called quant quake, where we've seen a lot of hedge fund long short strategies kind of basically blow up with some of the biggest losses in a decade, even longer in some cases. So we're seeing a lot of signs of instability, I think, in policymaking in the markets. But right now, the optimism is that China and the U.S. are coming to some agreement to try to put some type of trade deal together, even if it's a limited agreement. And the markets are in a bit of a melt-up. So not an easy environment to navigate, but we just come in every day and do the best we can.
So last week we had Draghi, and this week we've got Powell. To what degree do you think the Draghi announcement and the ECB move is just to kind of smooth the transition to Lagarde, make sure that you've got the best case scenario for an easy baton being passed? Draghi's done this year. Christine Lagarde takes over. Does that have anything to do with it? Or are they really looking at the same kinds of things that the Powell Fed would be? This vague notion of uncertainty, and maybe we should be proactive in getting out in front of a crisis versus being responsive. Let's just not let it happen at all in the first place.
Yeah, and what I didn't mention before, we've had this historic collapse in safe haven yields. Bund yields, German bund yields, made it to negative 75 basis points, with Swiss yields in, you know, negative 110. I think with Draghi is, after 8 years, the last thing he wants to do, I guess this was his second to the last meeting, he doesn't want to disappoint the markets. And the yields have collapsed, and there's a lot of pressure on not just the ECB, but the Fed and the Bank of Japan to accommodate these markets and continue to stimulate. And I think central bankers are, candidly, I think they're really scared to disappoint markets because they've seen how quickly things can unravel.
Particularly if Draghi's handing out his resume again and might be going back to the private sector, maybe rehired by Goldman, perhaps. It'd be nice to offer something to the gods of the marketplace.
Well, and the market reaction was not that positive, and we learned that there was a lot of dissension in that ECB meeting. And I think there'll be a lot of dissension in the Fed meetings. There's just a disagreement on how to deal with this environment. There are central bankers that don't believe that negative interest rates are helpful. They don't believe they should continue to stimulate the markets. They don't want the markets to dictate monetary policy, but they're kind of stuck. And I think with Draghi, he just takes it upon himself to push through the policy he wants.
It was only, you know, 3 years ago that we had a conversation with Carmen Reinhart at Harvard, and her opinion was that negative rates represented a form of picking the public's pocket. And there was actually something of a moral tone in that conversation where she really didn't think it was the right thing to do. Not just because it wouldn't functionally get an economy going again. And I guess that case has been made in Europe if you're looking at negative rates there for a couple of years. And really, it's not a, you know, they're not lighting anything on fire in a positive sense. But what we see last week, the Fed is now categorically, they're boneheads. Our president says they're boneheads because they won't put rates in negative territory. Shed some light on this. Negative rates, the number keeps on growing. At the same time, perhaps not by coincidence, gold keeps on marching higher. You know, we were at 6 trillion and then at 8 trillion, then at 10 trillion, and then at 13 trillion in negative yielding bonds. Now we're at 17 trillion. And I don't know that there's a limit to it, particularly if the Fed jumps on board. As you said, it's not a uniform decision at the Federal Reserve, but now you've got political pressure from the president too, saying we should be at zero, we should be at negative. This just makes sense.
Right. And I think a lot of this is just built on this belief, this perception that central bankers have this all under control. They want to give the message that they have plenty of ammunition. And at this point, what ammunition do they have? I guess negative rates and more QE. So I think they're very hesitant to not go forward with rate reductions, even if they're negative. They feel a lot of pressure to continue with QE just to continue this view that they have things under control. At some point, the markets are not going to respond favorably to this, and then we'll find out the central bankers don't have a lot of ammunition left and don't have global markets under control. Everything works fine as long as the markets are going up, as long as bond prices go up, yields collapse, as long as equity prices go up. It seems like it all works and everything's well under control. As we saw in December, again, when risk off unfolds, quickly things look less than manageable.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, we had kind of that reversal of trend where all of a sudden rates are moving up a bit and bond prices are coming down. And, you know, as you say, it all works as long as the plan is followed. But what if the market doesn't cooperate? What if yields do go up, bond prices do go down in this leveraged environment? What did you take away from the volatility in the bond market a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, my view is that bond markets have been in a dislocation and that the collapse in yields has forced a lot of derivative players to take leverage long positions in the derivatives market to hedge their exposure. And it's just been a melt up in prices, a collapse in yields. It's a speculative dynamic. It's a bubble. I don't believe that there won't be consequences from that. And we saw a taste of that, right? As you mentioned, a couple of weeks of sharp reversal in yields. And all of a sudden, a lot of money that's gone into bond ETFs found out how quickly safe bonds can lead to losses. So I think we've seen, you know, maybe an important inflection point, at least a recognition now that there is significant risk in bonds, and it's not just a one-way market with easy money to be made by all.
You know, so we do this every week. We have the macro overview. Sometimes we'll bring in a third party, a technical analyst to give us some insights and also some perspective that might represent almost a risk management tool. What are we missing as we look at fundamentals? Is there something in the technical picture that can help? Lila, one of the things that you focus on too is fundamentals relating to specific companies that we're interested in, either that we're going to make allocations to, and your work as an analyst is digging into the details. I wonder, you know, we're talking about the macro environment being a challenge and sort of this melt-up environment. Explain perhaps our mode of operation in a melt-up environment.
Thank you, David. So Doug talked a bit about the collapse in safe haven yields, and there's been some unwind of this, but from a top-down perspective, clearly this is good for gold and precious metal stocks, as the Fed is obviously a friend of the gold price, but we have seen how quickly this can change. And you alluded to negative rates picking the public's pocket, and I think that has broader implications for
every asset with a fixed income or an income component.
Yes. Anything, you know, particularly in our universe of hard assets, particularly infrastructure or specialty real estate, those stocks have seen an unbelievable melt up year to date. We did see some unwind of that last week. We saw how quickly the environment can change. But as a result of this, we have not been particularly aggressive in putting new money to work and have taken a very incremental approach to migrating portfolios toward our model.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you would make the case for hard assets, for real assets, your elevator pitch on why that even makes sense. Assume that I don't know anything about anything as it relates to monetary policy, fiscal policy, the world gone, you know, wild, the credit markets gone amok, as Doug has described them accurately. Why do you want hard assets or real assets? Why not just own some Tesla, Facebook, and Apple and call it good?
Well, in a world of global negative real interest rates, whether it's here or in Europe, investors need inflation protection and they need assets that have physical and stable value, but also the ability to generate income above and beyond, you know, what you can get in T-bills, but they can do so in a defensive way that have dividends that are well covered. And it's a total return proposition. So, you know, you've got the upside of cash flow growth, but you also have a store of value. You have a physical gold is great. Gold is money. But in a world where the Fed is propping up all asset prices, diversification of the definition of a hard asset, we think, is important.
Yeah, and one of the challenges of gold is that it generally doesn't pay a dividend, certainly not the commodity. Now, if you're talking about
one
of
the stocks.
Very rarely. And when they do, it's a pittance. But what you're saying
is
there...
because the returns on capital from mining gold have been so poor over the cycle and frankly argue for a higher gold price.
Yeah. And there's an argument to be made for a broader definition of hard assets and real assets. So when you say infrastructure, when you say specialty real estate, you're talking about real things just that have a natural cash flow component to them. If it's infrastructure, I mean, the infrastructure that we know, whether it's electricity or water, there's lots of things that you have to have if you have a functional culture, society, and there's cash that's exchanged for those services. And so you're talking about the real asset itself, but some income or cash flow component with it. So that's a key distinction between a hard asset in a more general category and a precious metals category.
And as long as the company has the ability to pay out those cash flows based on their balance sheet and their other capital needs, whether it's sustaining capital or, you know, obviously the dividend is a fixed cost for the company as well.
So part of the work that you do is digging into the balance sheets and saying, all right, well, how stable are those cash flows? They can make a payment today and you can get excited about a dividend yield of X today, but is it going to be the same tomorrow? Do they have the resources? Do you have enough visibility on that company where this is a fairly predictable proposition as opposed to sort of having negative surprise waiting in the wings because you didn't do the research?
Well, and that's part of the reason that gold companies and really any company with any sort of commodity cyclicality really is not going to have a high dividend payout ratio, because part of the definition of a stable dividend is the ability to, you know, to fund it out of existing cash flow. So if they can't do that, then, you know, they're either going to have to go raise equity or issue debt in order to meet that other fixed cost.
When you look at this environment, is this the easiest environment you've ever operated in, the hardest environment you've ever operated in, the most boring environment you've ever operated
Definitely
in?
Definitely not boring. No, it has been a real challenge because as these portfolios are being built out, the key challenge really has been the desire to mitigate any commodity price volatility inherent in, you know, more cyclical, whether it's timber or copper, whatever, the ability to mitigate that volatility with the more stable income parts of the hard assets area is largely nullified because those valuations have gotten so extreme and it makes capital allocation a real challenge. The one place I see it not really being as big a challenge is gold stocks, because those stocks are largely still at cyclical lows, even though they've had in many cases big year-to-date runs. So that has been a research focus for us. But this recent rotation away from stable income after we saw the unwind of the yield trade last week, hopefully will present an opportunity for us to get more invested.
Doug, You're our in-house master of the spreadsheet. I think we actually call you King. What's our nickname?
I actually have him saved on my phone as King Spreadsheet.
King Spreadsheet.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so the details matter. Every cell matters. And we appreciate that about you. There's a lot of work that goes into managing a short position. Not only the analytics side of appreciating the context that you're in, but experience has taught you that there are also many pitfalls that even an experienced professional investor can fall into being on the short side of the market. Now, I am happy to say that in recent weeks, as we've seen some volatility, what you've done has stood up very, very well. I think as we've talked about some of our competitors, I'm surprised they still have a franchise literally after the last 2 weeks. I mean, it's been unbelievable to witness and unbearable, I'm sure, for their investors, but it just, they're not managing risk the way you are. The process must be different because the result is different. So I don't know how much detail you want to shed on that, but how is it that your results are so different than the competition? Is it just a question of risk indifference? Is it a question of having different parameters for risk mitigation? What's going on and how do you end up? You've often said you wear the dunce cap. That's not true. I'm looking at half our competitors. I know where the dunce cap sits.
Yeah, shorting's tough, David. You know, this is what I've been doing now going back to 1990. So I have the gray hair to prove it. A lot of scars along the way. And as I've said in the past, learning a lot of hard lessons the hard way. Shorting's different. It's not the opposite of being long, right? Shorting, you have a different risk profile. Stocks can go to zero, but the upside is unlimited. The risk of shorting is high in certain environments. It can be extremely high. What we do at MWM with Tactical Short is, you know, we really focus on risk and reward. We look a lot at the macro environment, a lot at the market environment, and we're trying to gauge how risky is it to be short? And if it's a high risk environment, then you've got to position to be able to get through that type of a backdrop. We know it's a high risk environment for shorting. It has been. Market tops are notoriously very difficult on the short side because you get a lot of this volatility. I remember back the first quarter of 2000 when you could see industry fundamentals throughout technology deteriorating rapidly. Well, that didn't matter. The stocks went on one last parabolic run. The shorts got squeezed. There was an unwind of a lot of bearish derivatives. And, you know, the NASDAQ hit its all-time high in March of 2000 in the midst of an industry downturn. Of course, the markets quickly reversed and went into a bear market. But it can be really tough trying to call a top on the short side, again, because of the squeeze risk. Right now, you have a lot of hedge funds shorting. You have a lot of long short strategies. You have a lot of trend following trading activity. All of that creates a backdrop where you can get these short squeezes where all of a sudden bearish positions are a crowded trade. And if they start to go against the people that are short, then you can get panic covering, especially if a lot of these short portfolios are part of long short strategies. And all of a sudden the longs are going down when the shorts are going up. And some of these strategies lost 5, 6, 7% in a day. So there has been a major short squeeze. We've avoided that because we knew the probabilities were high for a short squeeze. So in this type of environment, we're happy to get our market exposure away from popularly shorted stocks. We're happy at times to be short the S&P 500 as our hedge. So this has been a good environment to avoid being squeezed by these a lot of these individual company shorts.
Lila's itching to say something. Let's come back to the upside beta problem when she's done.
Well, I was just going to make the point that in the energy market, that has been particularly true, where we saw a massive short squeeze this past week. But the stocks that went up most were the worst quality companies where, you know, your good quality balance sheet, good management, good asset base, those stocks really didn't make much of a move at all. It was really, the move was concentrated around what I've been referring to as zombie companies, companies that really don't even have a reason to exist.
Right. And in the market, in a speculative market environment, I don't think there's too many ways to make money easier or faster than in a short squeeze. We saw one of our competitors, I think they lost 12%. One of the bearish mutual funds lost 12% in 8 trading days. So if you're on the right side of that squeeze, if you're buying those stocks ahead of a short squeeze, you can make a lot of money. So that gathers a lot of attention. And what happens on the short side? You can build a portfolio of individual company shorts and you can be very careful, right? And you can have them across the industry groups, and you can believe that it's a highly diversified portfolio. And then all of a sudden, if there's a squeeze, the correlations turn, all the positions are highly correlated. It doesn't matter if it's a retailer or an oil services company or a bank. All of a sudden, they all go up together because that's where the short positions are. And David, you mentioned the upside beta. What that means is you have a portfolio where in a normal market environment, let's say you manage your beta carefully, where let's say if the market goes up, you might lose 100% of that move on the short side, or if you have a lower beta, you could lose 80% of the upside move in the S&P. Well, all of a sudden in these short squeezes in this upside beta, you all of a sudden can have a beta of a -3. As we saw with the Goldman Sachs short index and one of our competitors, the S&P went up 4%. The Goldman Sachs short index went up 12%, and one of the bearish funds lost 12%. That's something to, you have to navigate around. You have to manage that, because we're not going to manage money for investors and lose 12% in 8 sessions. That's unacceptable.
It's just, again, back to the details, back to King's spreadsheet, back to the sales matter and the risk mitigation matters and the process matters. And I think one of the things that we have benefited from, we started managing money in 2008. McIlvany Wealth Management did. And we're coming into our 4th year with you, Doug. And Lila just joined us this year. There's more and more influence as time goes on from you, Doug, in terms of that risk mitigation and in terms of the process, an overlay. And it's helpful, not only on the short side, because that's where you spend the majority of your time, but also as a market strategist for the multiplier, accumulator, protector, and the other styles that we manage. You also play on that side too, helping give a risk management overlay. Lila, I mean, this is, again, this is not your first rodeo.
To be clear, this is my first rodeo in this kind of forum, so you'll have to forgive me for being quite a bit nervous about it.
No, but not your first rodeo in terms of your 3rd decade in the financial markets, and you've seen...
And I, too, have the gray hair to prove it.
Oh, you, 2 of them. But when you look at this, there's challenges, obviously, in what we're doing, but we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't think there was also a significant opportunity. And to engage in the financial markets today is not just for entertainment value. We think there's real opportunity in what we're doing, both with the MAP strategies focused on hard and real assets and on tactical short, looking at what is an overblown market, both in terms of valuations and also the structure of the market. Doug, you mentioned earlier, everybody's buying bonds and loves to do it through ETFs, and it doesn't realize that, you know, 5 lanes of traffic go in when you're buying, but it's like a goat trail coming out. There's not quite the liquidity. The structure's different. Doesn't work in reverse.
And the bond proxies have been very much the same thing. Both the infrastructure stocks, the specialty real estate, which I call bond proxies because they have a stable income component. It's been exactly the same thing, where there was a rush to the exits last week, and all of a sudden you had stable income stocks that are down 3%, 4%, 5% in a day.
Give us either one of you can jump in on this. Maybe you can articulate, what is the opportunity? Why are we doing this?
I'll jump in. I'll go first. You know, David, I've been following, you know, macro analysis. My obsession, I guess, started back in 1987 with the stock market crash and the late 80s Japanese bubble, and I haven't given up. And I just look at this, we're at very late stages of a multi-decade credit bubble. It's gone global. It's gone to the heart of money and credit. I think there's major changes coming soon. I think the bull case for precious metals and hard assets is extremely compelling. And I think the opportunities to provide a vehicle to hedge against declining risk markets, to provide a place for people to protect their wealth, I think that is one of the great opportunities I've seen during my career. So, you know, I'm excited about what we're doing, and not easy right now, of course. Market tops are not easy. And I think, you know, this is a multi-decade market top, and it's dragging out for a lot longer than I would have thought. David, we wouldn't have started tactical short, you know, when we did, if we thought it was going to drag on this long. But I'm more excited than ever about the opportunities.
And it's, you know, we talked about this a bit earlier in the office. The truth is, we don't really know how long the Fed, global central banks, we don't know how long they can keep balls in the air. It's gone on a lot longer than I ever imagined it could, or Doug ever imagined it could. And giving clients the ability to have assets with physical intrinsic value, but at the same time can also generate cash and diversification, as well as, you know, pretty low correlation to the broader market, that's a compelling and attractive proposition. In some areas of the market, the valuations are actually quite good, particularly on, you know, some of your materials companies, such as timber and agriculture, even industrial commodities, and frankly, precious metals. I think there are great opportunities in precious metal stocks as well, even though we've seen a tremendous run-up year to date. So even though markets are trading near all-time highs, I think there's still great pockets of value in areas where we can really add some value for clients and help their portfolios generate stable and growing cash flow.
I'm going to answer the question a little bit differently and say that the greatest opportunity I have seen in my adult life is sitting right here at the table, where we're talking about, in my opinion, a world-class team and developing world-class products. And there is this Latin phrase, quid diende, which is asking a question, what is next? We've been in business for 50 years. We've placed billions of dollars into the precious metals market. We have tens of thousands of clients across the country who have participated in a move from gold at $300, $400, $500, $600, $700, $800 to the present levels. And we've, I think, got a little bit of headroom here. But what is next is sitting right here, a world-class team developing world-class products that add value for folks that want to know what is next. And I think for many of those clients, it is a question of, we've done a good job hedging ourselves, and we see that the insurance component of gold paying off. And now we're to a point in life where we need income. We need to have a broader diversification. We need to look at our life needs and how are we going to meet those? Politically, we determined we can't eat iPads. I think that was in the debates, or I forget which, Fed president said, I think it was Bill Dudley. He was talking about inflation and iPads. We can't eat iPads. Well, we can't eat gold either. And I think that's one of the things that we look at and we say, what is next? This is what's next. This is what's next. So to me, the opportunity is sitting right here, refining processes, refining the team over time, adding just the right people. And you know, for me, this has been a 10-year journey to finally have what I consider to be the A-team. There'll be more people on the team as time goes by, probably different products that we offer of a varied nature, complementary and philosophically compatible, values-driven, compatible with who we are and how we see the world. But when I see the big opportunity, I consider it a privilege to work with the two of you. I mean, to me, full stop, there's such a deep level of satisfaction getting to work with professionals, being in meetings where, you know, listen, I may be the boss, but it doesn't mean that Doug's not going to chew me out.
And we all got a taste of that last week, didn't we?
Yeah.
I'm kidding. What are you talking about?
And no, but it speaks to who we are as a group, who we are as a team. Professionalism demands our very best. And that's what we want to do. We want to offer our very best to a client base, work our tails off, and put a product or a number of products out there that serve their needs, that answer their questions, that answer that question, quid diende, what is next?
Well, and, you know, Doug and I have worked together in the past for, you know, well over a decade. And in any team environment, there's always going to be, I don't want to say conflict, that's way too strong a word, but there are always going to be disagreements, and how that's handled and how it ultimately makes process better, you know, is what we're looking to achieve. And, you know, having those disagreements, I think, has made us all better, because what comes out of it is better ways to handle process.
The only way I can say that we're developing a world-class suite of products is by coming back to, well, how high is the bar set? And that's where the wrath of Doug may be on display, but it's because the bar is set high.
So you get roasted in this environment. I think that's fantastic.
Wait until our next meeting.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm out next Monday.
Yeah, okay. So that's Monday and Wednesday, and it's a look at the macro fundamentals, and it's a look at the micro fundamentals bottom up from a company perspective.
And from a top down industry perspective too. Like, yep. I think there are enough people in this room that have a lot to add on the macro side, but from a top down industry fundamentals, I think, you know, that's also my sandbox.
So we're at this every week. It's the processes we follow. We do love having outside voices come in and from that technical perspective, having a different set of insights to complement and even challenge assumptions or directions or decisions that we're in the process of making. And the end result is allocation choices and a gradual process. Those shifts are occurring every week, and it's a beautiful thing to behold. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, David, what we're doing, it's rigorous, you know, bottom up meets top down with the technical overlay. It's group management, a team approach where we all come in with our own opinions.
Group management, though, without group think, I think.
Oh, no group think. Yeah. We all have our own strong opinions, and that's what makes a dynamic meeting, a dynamic discussion, and that's how you come to the best decision making.
And I also think we all know what the other person is really good at, and I have absolutely nothing to add on macro analysis.
I don't know. You asked some pretty good questions.
And I think my history with Doug is that he asks some really good questions on the micro analysis side, but also has largely left that, left the granularity and the details to me to deal with.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that, Lila. You're a diligent analyst, thorough, diligent, and obsessive, which I love.
I will say, I mean, if you wanted to pull out characteristics that we all share in common, there is an obsessive nature to all of us in varying degrees and with particular focuses. And I think that's one of the reasons we're passionate about what we do. We care about what we do. This is not a passing fancy. It's something that has a deep level of dedication. It taps the core of our curiosity and our drive.
And David, thanks for bringing us together, because we're going to build something special here. And it's a special group of people, and I'm honored to be part of the organization. And you know, thanks for putting this together.
The honor's mine.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and Doug Noland and Lila Murphy. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.